Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. In this hour, we're going to share a lot of very empowering information, including you'll hear from Vandana Shiva, and I think you'll be inspired by her. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. This comes from the Salk Institute, and it's about an anti-aging nutrient. Now, a lot of us in the field have used it, recommended, but now there's more information. In a publication of the recent finding of Mayo Clinic researchers and the Salk Institute, they found that it has a strong, what is called senolytic, S-E-N-O-L-Y-T-I-C effect for fistin, F-I-S-E-T-I-N. By the way, that's found in plants. If you're on a vegan diet and juicing, good for you, because strawberries, grapes, apples, onions, and cucumbers are a good source of it. The article is published in the current Journals of Gerontology series, and researchers from the Salk Institute reported a reduction in aging-related inflammation and cognitive decline in mice given fistin. And acting on earlier findings of a decrease in memory loss associated with fistin, supplementation in mice that were genetically modified to develop Alzheimer's disease, they found it made a big difference. So, you might want to include this in your diet. It's not difficult to get. It's not expensive. Mind you, it's not a cure-all. It's just one piece of a massive puzzle. F-I-S-E-T-I-N. All right? And the differences in the groups were striking, according to the Salk Cellular Neurobiology Laboratory. So if you can take all these nutrients that I've mentioned over a period of years, such as L-carnosine, L-carnitine, coenzyme Q10, resveratrol, pine bark extract, NAD, the omega-3 fatty acids, omega-6 fatty acids, they're all with quercetin, vitamin C, all working synergistically together. Now, another study from Yale University, breast cancer overdiagnosis is common among older women. This is important. A study of more than 50,000 women found that continued breast cancer screening after the age of 70 was associated with a greater incidence of cancer that likely would not have caused symptoms in the patient's lifetime. These findings suggest that overdiagnosis may be common among older women who are diagnosed with breast cancer after screening. The study is published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. So just if, and by the way, why don't we start emphasizing other forms of breast screening than mammography or mammograms? You can get a very good clinician, an oncologist, to do an examination before they go for a mammogram. All right? And I'm not saying not to get them. I'm just saying that according to clinical guidelines, advising screening in older women vary because the balance of benefits and harms of screening in this population is unclear. Possible harms of screening in older women include frequent false positives. That's not good. So what if you get a false positive and you put someone on chemotherapy or radiation or even surgery? That could end up causing their life at the end. And also, we don't want invasive testing and procedures. And overdiagnosis itself is now considered an important additional harm from screening. Overdiagnosis may be defined as detecting a cancer, often through screening, that would not have caused symptoms in a person's entire lifetime. And this was done at Yale School of Medicine. They conducted a retrospective study of 54,000 women age 70 and older. So, something to consider. Now, another study is from Oxford University in the United Kingdom. A vegan diet has just 30% of the environmental impact of a high meat diet. That's a major study. We know that meat has a substantial impact on the planet in a negative way, and that plant-based diets are more environmentally sustainable. But exactly how much impact does the food we eat have on environmental outcomes, and what difference would it be to follow a vegan diet to be compared to consuming a high meat diet, which the average American's on? So they studied at Oxford University 55,000 people's dietary data and link what they ate or drank to five key measures: greenhouse gas emissions, land use, water pollution, and biodiversity loss. The results are now published in Nature Food, and they found that vegans have just 30% of the dietary environmental impact of high meat eaters. Now, why is this important? Because after I traveled on one of like 20 or 30 trips to Great Britain doing research back in the 1970s, and I met the leading doctors and scientists like Dr. Yetkin, and there were about three or four different doctors who all believed in high fiber diets. Now, they didn't talk about meat, but they talk about fiber. They talk about more vegetables and fruits in the diet. And there was also Dr. John Cleave, who said that he was a captain, medical doctor in the Royal Navy, and you would start seeing subclinical scurvy. This is 1940s, not the 1800s, where people were at sea for months at a time and ended up with scurvy and dying. And they would have all forms of bowel problems, constipation. They're just, everything was out of a can. Everything was powdered. And it was a terrible diet. But the moment they hit land, especially in the tropics, they would load up on all the fruits and vegetables they could get, and tubers and fish, and people returned to good health. And he was the one who first advocated for high fiber diets in all the scientific literature. So anyhow, I came back and I was very impressed with these older people. I was in my young 20s, they were in their 70s. And I began to see how much fiber the average American have, and it was like 5 grams, but they said we needed 40 grams. So we were really undernourished as far as our fiber, and fiber lowers your cholesterol. Fiber also sweeps a lot of that excess estrogen out of the body, and you don't want excess estrogen. That can lead to prostate cancer, it can lead to breast cancer, ovarian cancer. In any case, that's when I started advocating, and I started doing my own laboratory research with high fiber. And wow, made a huge difference. I'm just sharing this with you because we need to be conscious of not only our physical health, but environmental health. And that's why I'm a vegan, and that's why I advocate veganism. But we had about 4% of Americans in the 1970s who were vegetarian, about 1%, a little over, who were vegan. Today, it's not a whole lot better. So what's happened? That's a question I'd like you to address. What happened with the thousands of articles and best-selling books and broadcasts, all the information, and thousands of articles in the peer-reviewed journals, Mediterranean diet, the Okinawa diet, the Creek diet? These are all healthy diets, principally vegetarian. What do you think has caused us not to make this change? Propaganda, advertising, conditioning, peer pressure? I'd like to hear from you. And I'd like to hear from those in the audience who were on a principally high-protein, meat-based diet and then switched over to a vegetarian or vegan diet. What were the changes you saw? Give us a call, please. 888-874-4888. And I'll do one last thing here. So you're doing a good job. And by the way, Where are all the millions, tens of millions of young people, teenagers who were just enthralled by Greta Thunberg and about, you know, helping save the planet? How about that was a nothing burger? Nothing changed. None of them changed. All right? Maybe a few, but the statistics bear out. We're eating more meat now than ever before. And also, for those of you who have high blood pressure, there's one way you can help bring it down. That's black beans. Yes, this is from the National Polytech Institute in Mexico. Beans, of course, if you've been to Central South America, Mexico, it's a very important part of their diet, and it's very healthy. Lots of good B complex and vitamin C and amino acids are in there. But they wanted to see what is the antioxidant and anti-hypertensive activity in a variety of black beans. The variety is called Jamapa, J-A-M-A-P-A. And they found that in addition to good qualities, lowers your blood pressure, proteins in the beans can remove heavy metals, lead, cadmium, mercury. So How about that? Have some black beans in your diet and help cleanse the body of heavy metals and bring down your blood pressure at the same time. Why? Because they identified bioactive peptides in the legumes that have a beneficial effect on antioxidants, low antioxidants to bring them up, and hypertension to bring it down. So it also helps prevent cardiovascular disease. And that's good, all good. And by the way, one last thing, consuming added sugar may increase risk of kidney stones. North Shoshone Medical College, and that's not good. So get rid of the sugar. By the way, we have a lot of people, thousands of people, going over to Gary Noll YouTube and watching the non-controversial, these are not my hard-hitting investigative journalist articles or essays. Instead, just good quality information. Yesterday, I did a whole report on dental care. That'll overcome everything from grinding of your teeth to cavitation to cavities and changing the good bacteria in your mouth, etc. But I have hundreds of these. They're free. They're public service. And all my information, the footnotes show, came from the National Library of Medicine. So we're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. I'm going to take you to a clip now that I believe is both insightful and uplifting and gives us some understanding of what we individually and collectively can do to take back power from those who've abused it. You're going to hear from Vandana Shiva, in my opinion, one of the great oracles of our time. And we filmed at her farm, phenomenal farm, never seen anything like it in my life. Mind you, in India, they have over 1,000 variety of mangoes alone. And you think of one or two. Well, they are collecting seeds from all over the world to preserve them and share them. And also, she's being interviewed by Russell Brand. And I really appreciate what Russell Brand's doing. He's got a large audience, around 6.5 million people follow him each day. Good for him. And he's not as frenetic as he used to be. Very hard to watch him. Because, first of all, between his accent and his physical posturing and movements and how fast he speaks, it was not a comfortable watch, even if it was important, accurate information. In this case, he's calmed down, more focused, and lets her talk, which is good. So let's now go to this clip, and it's going to be in three parts. Part one today, part two tomorrow, part three the day after. And they're dealing with a lot of issues. BlackRock, Vanguard, who controls the food, who controls the farms, who controls technology, and how they're conditioning you to trust them. That's a big mistake. All right, now we go to the clip. And then afterwards, if you'd like to call in and share any of the insights that you've learned in your own way, please feel free to do so. I'd like to hear from you. 888-874-4888. Oh, and by the way, right after that clip, we're going to go to a break and come right back from that break into a young person. I don't know how old they are. They look like they're about 19. They may be in their early 20s. It's a young woman, African-American woman, speaking about how and why she left the left. And boy, does she nail some important issues that all of us should be thinking about. I've interviewed people who left the right, and now there's just a flood of people leaving the left. And why? Why the most? Well, we'll hear from her. So we're going to go to the clip, a break, and back to her. And then if you'd like to call in and share your views, please do so. Now, again, you can agree with her or disagree with her in part or whole. We have an open form of no censorship policy. I don't censor. I may disagree with someone, but as you see in my debates with them, I treat them with respect. I listen to them. I let them talk. Then I respond. And I do so in a manner that is civil and courteous, showing respect. I can disagree with them. Doesn't mean that I don't hate them. And yet today, I couldn't get on the major media to do debates on 5G or on, you know, on COVID, any of the issues that I know a lot about. And they don't want to hear from those who could challenge them and possibly convince the people there are other truths other than their own. Now to the clip.
Hello there, you awakening wonders. Thanks for joining me for Stay Free with Russell Brand. Today, I want to share with you a beautiful conversation I had with Vandana Shiva. What will astonish you about Vandana Shiva is her ability to confront corruption, her willingness to articulate complex issues, her willingness to confront head-on the accusation that I know you will have faced, that you're a conspiracy theorist, that you're right-wing, how these smears and slurs are used to censor and control conversation. We also talk about how Big Food received $400 billion in subsidies to make highly processed food look cheaper, the true power of BlackRock and Vanguard, and how the World Bank and IMF are linked and how they really work. You're going to love this conversation. Let me know what you think in the chat. Please welcome to the stage one of my great teachers, the great mother herself, this glorious woman who's peculiarly humble, who's recently given me this amazing gift that's got a great story behind it. Please welcome Vandana Shiva. Vandana Shiva, thank you so much for joining us for Community. You came last year. For us, it was absolutely necessary, vital, necessary that you came again. I'm so pleased and thrilled that you're here. Thank you very much for this gift. Would you mind starting off our conversation by explaining to our beautiful, loving community what this gift is and its significance as you explained it to me? Thank you.
So, Russell, as you know, since 84, I've dedicated my life to understand the puzzles of why our agriculture and food system destroys the earth, destroys farmers, and destroys our health. And from 87 onwards, when those who, through chemicals, have created industrial agriculture, talked about owning the seed and patenting the seed through GMOs, I started to save seeds. But originally only crop seeds and food seeds and vegetable seeds. But in the areas where cotton was growing, an epidemic of suicides of farmers started. Within no time, all cotton, 95% of cotton, had become Monsanto's BT cotton, a GMO cotton. And these are the areas where 85% of the 400,000 suicides have taken place. 400,000 suicides of farmers in India. And so I did a pilgrimage to understand why the farmers were taking their lives. I realized it was the seed monopoly. So I spent years finding some place where we would have the old cotton varieties. We found them. They're lovely. The beauty about seed is it multiplies, just like community multiplies. And so with little bits of seed, we started to multiply it. We've trained hundreds of thousands of farmers to do organic farming. And then we've taken that organic cotton to the ashrams that Gandhi in his time had started, because he fought the British Empire by bringing out the spinning wheel and said, till we make our own cloth, we will be slaves. We have to learn how to produce again. And he started spinning cloth, and the whole country started to spin cloth. So we went to those ashrams. They take the organic cotton, and they hand spin, hand weave, hand print. Each of those leaves is printed with vegetable and natural dye, indigo in this case, with love. So every fiber is full of love. It's full of nonviolence. And I call it the fiber of freedom. And like that, we must grow foods of freedom everywhere. And have thoughts of freedom everywhere, which is what I think you're trying to sow with the community festival.
Yes, because I believe very deeply in individual freedom. I believe in it. It's beyond belief. It is a deep and intuitive feeling. I sense sometimes that that globalism is not only vast, but globalism is small. It intercedes where we might have relationships with one another. It intercedes where we might have relationships with nature. That all things have become commodity and commodified. In our first conversation, I was struck by the way you spoke of the desacralization of the earth. Can you speak to us about this desacralization, what this process means, and how we might begin to reverse it?
I think most indigenous cultures held the earth as sacred, saw the earth as terra madre. We have 1,000 names for her, Vasundhara, Bhumi, Gaia, the Greek name. And the earth was desacralized when the land was colonized. Because what had to be taken was the land and its productive power. And while the land was appropriated and desacralized, the idea of knowledge was redefined. You know, Bacon in this country, he used to be the chancellor, ran the witch hunts, he ran the Inquisition of this country.
What do you mean? You mean specifically Wales and Britain, that there were witch hunts where people...
No, huge. 9 million people in Europe killed for thinking independently. Women healers knowing which plant heals. Joan of Arc, you remember? And he was in charge of that in this country. And he wrote a book called The Masculine Birth of Time. Yeah, in India, we think of time as Kali. Yeah? She is the perennial circularity. And in The Masculine Birth of Time, he says, I will teach you how to make nature a slave. At the same time, Robert Boyle, the governor of the Church of England, who was responsible for a lot of the New England colonization, I think he was the one behind Boyle's law, he writes, the idea that that nature is sacred comes in the way of our empire, and it must be destroyed. And the common narrative we get is the church and the Enlightenment were in conflict. No. The church was implementing the reductionist mechanistic philosophy that we are separate from nature. Nature is just raw material, what Satish was talking this morning. Nature is merely property. And at the same time, while the enclosures of the commons were taking place on this land, the colonization was taking place elsewhere. Now, forests and rivers and land were being enclosed. But here, the enclosures took 2 centuries. That's how much the peasants fought. 2 centuries. And Locke did not talk about the enclosures, but he writes about how the first nations of America are primitive people. They don't enslave their bison. They don't fence their fields. And therefore, we must take away their land and just leave enough for their survival. And that's how private property, he defined private property as the mixing of human labor with nature. But that means anyone who works the land has rights. No, but it's not the work of a farmer. It's not the work of the horse that plows the field. It's the spiritual labor of capital. So capital, which was totally a construct, appropriated not just the earth, appropriate spirituality. And that's where things started to go wrong. And that desacralization also meant no reverence, no limits, no knowledge of living systems. And to me, the ecological crisis begins there. India was colonized, and in 1780s, Lord Cornwallis wrote that all the land of India belonged to England. All the soil of India belonged to England, and therefore England couldn't collect rents from the peasants who were growing the food, who became landless overnight, and they had to pay half of what they grew as taxes. So they were driven to famine. $45 trillion was transferred to England. 60 million peasants died. That is the economy that comes from desacralization. That comes from not respecting nature or respecting the life of others or respecting their work and their labor or respecting their sovereignty. To me, sovereignty is sacred.
It's beautiful to hear you describe it so explicitly. Oh, yes, thank you.
Because I sometimes fall into the trap of believing, Vandana, that there was a kind of inevitable momentum, almost an inertia that has led us to materialism, that it's not the result of conscious choices and political decisions, not the result of declarations that we should separate ourselves from nature, that we should regard nature as a resource, that you have to break the nature between humanity and nature herself. It was also, it seemed plain, Vandana, and here is some gentle rain to remind us of our fallibility and of the limitless and abundant power of nature.
I want to pay them a compliment.
Yes, that, please.
You know, they've stayed for the rain.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for staying. Thank you for being so tolerant and gracious, because these, to remain so joyful and so abundant and so generous in such challenging conditions, for me is a demonstration that you have the necessary fortitude that will be required when any change is brought about. It will not be easy to change the world. It is not easy to sacrifice. It is not easy to recognize that the inner world is the real world and that we must practice there with honor and respect and regard, and we must overcome our materialistic models in favor of subtler forces that are sometimes difficult to access. Vandana, I felt that in your answer there was embedded within it, or in fact it was quite overt, that part of the process of the management and subjugation of nature involved the subjugation of women. If this is so, as you say, how do we begin to heal this wound while honoring both the masculine and feminine? Because in our culture, there is a lot of opposition. I think a lot of males are uncertain around about the role of masculinity. How can we ensure that the culture war doesn't prevent necessary conversations from taking place? How can we celebrate and honor the divine feminine without denigrating masculinity? How can we honor both of these forces after you have said that time is regarded as Kali and it was this masculine movement to time and it was about all of this oppression, when there seems to be simultaneously a movement to alienate men and women from one another?
Well, you know, just like the earth and nature were sacred in most indigenous cultures. And actually, the old research shows that even in Europe, the old temples were all goddess temples. There were no weapons. Yeah, they were all about the renewal of life, the sacredness of life, fertility of the earth. You know, the same process of colonialism that desacralized the earth also created gender polarization, first by pulling the men out to be the workers in the mines, in the factories, pulling them out from their homes. If you went to the commons, the men and women were equal workers. They were householders. And the economy was oikos, the economy of the household, maintaining the earth as our home, as well as our local homes, and women and men as equal partners. There was no gender conflict in my society, in tribal areas where I go to, you know, in so many tribal cultures, the men are doing all the cooking. They're taking care of the babies. All this is industrial society labels that define men do this, women do this. So men were pulled out. The economy of life, of continuing to survive, was left in the hands of women. Yeah? They're the ones who continue to grow the food, fetch the water, protect the children, the old people, something that's still going on now. So how do we overcome this very artificial duality? First, by realizing that the divine feminine is everything living, including in every man. So every man should celebrate, I'm the divine feminine. Who said the divine feminine is not in man? You know, the birth of masculine time that Bacon talked about was removing the divine feminine and trying to crush it. And that is what creates both the violence over the earth and violence in society, but then the emptiness within. And that emptiness then is what allows for more violence. I believe the femicide that is growing all the time in the world is a result of an emptiness. And that's why we need to go beyond this shallow identity politics into a deep identity that we are all Earth citizens We're all earth beings. We're all part of the divine. And together, as we awaken that divine in us, you know, of course there are differences, but those differences aren't the overriding determining factors of who we are. Who we are, being alive, comes as being part of the earth. The spirituality comes from both going within, but through that, being connected to the larger consciousness. Yeah.
Vandana, when you talk about this emptiness, it resonates with me, and I think it resonates with all of us. I think we understand what is being said. This emptiness, this sense that something is missing, that there is something has been absented and extracted. I speak from the perspective of an addict where there is unbridled yearning and longing and a sense somehow that the material or external world is going to provide the solutions to this. When you speak about the nature of identity, that we can honor individuality and diversity without creating unnecessary conflict, I understand what you are saying, and I believe you. How is it then, Vandana, that over the last 3 years we have found ourselves fraught with conflict? We have found ourselves to some degree imposed in places of division and isolation. Sometimes it feels, as with the example of the establishment of masculine time, that there is some coordination at play when it comes to this divisiveness. That power, while opaque, insidious and difficult to track, must be somewhere. Somewhere, decisions appear to be being made to turn people against one another, to make people sick because of the food they are eating, to perpetuate cycles of ill health. Where are these decisions being made? What are these systems? How do we identify them so that we can oppose them?
You know, when the East India Company was created, which is the first corporation, you know, corporations haven't been around forever. Businesses have been around, trade has been around, but not the corporation as a corporation that has rights but no responsibilities. That's what limited liability really means, no responsibility. That was just 300 men, merchant adventurers they were called, and they got together to say, you know, if our ships come home, we'll divide the wealth. If they don't, we take it from society. And that's what's going on. You know, the beautiful group of singers earlier were telling me that they still, in their salary, there's a deduction of a reparation that goes to the old slave owners who have to be paid because they lost their profits of slavery. Something we should be looking into. So where does all this thinking happen? At that time, 1600, the 300 people got together. And every time they start losing power, because then, you know, we threw out the East India Company, 1857, first freedom movement around bread, always around bread. And then the British Crown took over. But in 1947, we became free by spinning cloth. That's how we became free. Around the time we were becoming free, the rich men became the World Bank and IMF. You know, they created these instruments. I was at the 50th anniversary of the World Bank IMF in a place called Bretton Woods. It's a tiny place in New Hampshire in the US. And I went down to the basement where they had a shop. And the shop had the first day covers of that event. And the title of the first day covers Money Men of the World Meet. And they created the three Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank to lend and get you into debt, the IMF to bail you out of the debt, and GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which then became the WTO now, for the trade issue. It didn't become an institution because Cuba was put in charge. And Cuba said, what we need in trade is a correction of the harm of exploitation. So there was no acceptance of that till a new recolonization was put in place with the WTO in 1995. But these bureaucracies don't do the thinking. It's the corporations who want to use it as an instrument that does the thinking. So This I know deeply because I spent a lot of my time on this. When Monsanto wanted to own seed, then I started to follow GATT and WTO. Monsanto wrote the intellectual property rights agreement of WTO to define seed as their property, as their invention. And that's why I've dedicated my life to saving seeds and keeping seed free and keeping farmers free to have the right to save and exchange seed.
Hey, so I really feel compelled today to share my walkaway story. So my whole life I grew up and, you know, I was a Democrat. Like, everyone around me was a Democrat. People were Democrats, you know. I didn't really know anything other than the fact that Democrats were supposed to be the party that helped everyone. It was just this amazing party, and they were the good guys while the Republicans were the bad guys. And I didn't grow up in like a primarily black area. I grew up actually in a primarily white area. And you know, I went to public school all my life, and then I went to a private elite women's college for college. And you know, it's really interesting because I've never really been like a very political person. And I was too young when Obama was up for election both times. The first time I voted was in 2016, and I don't even know if they got my election, because honestly, I was at college, so I did a paper ballot. So who even knows, really? But I just remember being so incredibly upset when Hillary didn't win in 2016, because I was in my senior year of college, and you know, the whole campus was in tears because we were like, oh my God, Trump, he's this misogynist, this racist, this homophobe, this everything. And I even protested in Boston and was like, oh my God, this is terrible. Like, I was really, that's how far deep I was into this. And before I even went to college, I was nowhere near as radical as when I left college. Like, it was just crazy. Like, after I left college, I just like hated men. I hated anyone who disagreed with me, basically. And you know, I learned to protest in college, and I learned about being a social justice warrior and like posting all this stuff on Facebook for the Democrats and all this other stuff, because again, I thought they were the good guys. So fast forward like 3 years. I've been out of college 3 years now. And things really start, you know, I really liked Andrew Yang when I started to really like dig into who he was, and like he had a cool personality, and I was like, oh, like I could totally see this guy being president. I could support him. But then, you know, he dropped out of the race, and then I didn't really like any more people on the Democrat side. So I was kind of like, all right, well, whatever. And I was an economics major in college. So a lot of his economic policies honestly didn't make all that much sense, like the more I really thought about it. So slowly I kind of started to listen to people like Candace Owens and, you know, Charlie Kirk and the Rubin Report. But really, Candace Owens was my intro. And the more I listened to her, and the more I like actually looked into what she was saying and did my research, the more I realized that like the Democrats are literally like, they're all communists and Marxists. And I've always been like a capitalist, because I believe in the free market system. I think it's the best way to like for world prosperity, like the best system that's been created. And I also saw like through my studies that communism, socialism has never worked. And coming from my liberal arts background and seeing like how I was literally indoctrinated into believing that, you know, the Democrats were the best party, and you know, that socialism isn't that bad, and all this other stuff, it really got me thinking about the fact that I was brainwashed. And it was very liberating for me, because then I was like, oh my God, you know, I'm a free thinker now. Like, I can speak thoughts for myself. And so I came out on my Facebook profile, like in my community, and I was like, proud to be a Trump supporter, love to all. And I got so much hate from people. Like, it was insane. Like, you would have thought I was saying that I wanted to, like, kill people. But all I said is that I was voting for Trump. And I didn't say anything mean about anyone or anything like that. And I just got so much hate. And honestly, that only further validated the fact that I was brainwashed, because there was such a visceral, emotional reaction from people. And I was like, that's really, like, not right. If someone disagrees with you, you shouldn't be reacting so emotionally and, like, canceling them and doing all this stuff. Like, it didn't really make sense to me. So obviously I started to look into it more. I actually found the hashtag walkaway campaign maybe like a few weeks, months later. And I realized that this is a real problem. Like, our schools, our colleges, our everything is really indoctrinating people to be Democrats and, like, be communists, basically. And then I watched like a Trump rally, and I started really listening to, like, him speaking versus it being funneled through some sort of, like, mainstream media thing, like channel or paper or website or whatever. And I realized that they were totally misconstruing everything that this dude was saying and creating a narrative out of sound bites. And so I really caught on to the fact that it really is fake news. Like, he's been saying it. So, you know, after all that, and, like, telling some of my family members that I was a Trump supporter and, like, the disagreements we would get into, I realized, like, I could never vote for a Democrat ever again. And this is not to say that I'm going to blindly vote for Republicans, but in terms of the Democrats, like, I can't stand for that, you know? And also, like, I had spent some time in San Francisco, and I got to really see firsthand the homelessness situation there, and that whole state and city is run, they're all run by Democrats. So it's like, why is there such an issue there with homelessness if these Democrats are supposed to be helping the problem, and it's seemingly only getting worse, and there's such high taxes there? Like, people complain about that. So I'm like, you know what? This isn't matching up. Like, clearly the leadership is not fit to run this place, and I have to vote against that. So I've left the Democrat Party. I will never be back, and I just wanted to share this with the world. So, yeah, happy to be an independent or conservative independent, and more importantly, to just be a free thinker. So,
okay, that's one person, young person's views. I would take issue with several things. Before you say you would never vote ever again, understand that you have to look at what you're dealing with up to this moment. If you find that if you're a Republican, power is in office, like a George Bush Jr., Sr., Donald Trump, or Ronald Reagan, keep in mind, these are not the brightest people on the block. In fact, I consider them some of the dumbest human beings ever. But I also consider the Democrats, they're educated, yes, but they're disconnected from the reality of everyone else's world. Therefore, when they make a decision to go into Iraq, and they go into Afghanistan, they go into Ukraine, they overturn 54 governments, those are people individually working collectively who have used an office, Secretary of State, President, head of a corporation, to determine the outcome of people who had no say-so in the process. So what we should be looking at is not, let's say, either lionizing, praising, or condemning someone in office. That we can do individually. We can just judge them based upon what they do. And does that match what they promised? And if it doesn't, then find someone who we believe, based upon their background or life experience, they're consistent. They've done well for the public right up to that moment. It doesn't matter what their party is. That's irrelevant. Irrelevant. But what is important is don't make absolute generalizations of what you're not going to do or do because of what you have experienced in your young life up to this point. Life is far more complex than that. Last night, I saw a short clip sent to me where the head of the Young Turks was on, and his opening statement was that half of all people who voted for Donald Trump were deplorables. And one of the other panelists said, but that's 40 million people. He said, yeah. And then the other just misguided. Okay, how does he know those 40 million people are deplorable? What does it mean when you suddenly condemn 40 million people, none of whom you've ever met? Have you spent time in their towns and let's say in Detroit or Dearborn or Flint, where they were good Democrats, voted for the Democrats in their city government, the federal government, state government, never complained, but they had a quality of life. They had a standard of living. Their unions protected them. And now those unions are gone. And now they've waited 20, 30, 40 years for you to honor your word, and you haven't. Then who's the deplorable? The people who voted for Trump out of anger, out of disappointment, out of frustration, or the people who created those empty plants, those empty jobs that once were full and people could have one parent at home and the rest of their family supported, but quality of life, who are not immersed in debt? Why can't you take a look at who really causes these people's problems instead of judging in the most harsh, non-spiritual manner? Buddy, get a grip on it. Is your ego that big that you can't acknowledge you made a mistake? You don't judge 40 million people. You don't judge 40 people unless you know it. You don't judge black people by one who commits a crime on a subway or 10 who do something, as you wouldn't judge a white person for doing the same. You can't judge whole races, whole religious views, as Bill Maher did on Islam. If you start doing that, then you're the problem, manifesting your own beliefs because you have a form. And how restrained is a person using common sense, wisdom, and innate abilities to understand a crisis before you become a part of it? So this is the country we live in today. So agree or disagree, start to think deeper on these issues. Now, talk about something deep. For those of you who got the vaccine, fine, and believe completely and that you did the right thing, good. No one should shame you. But understand something. There's something going on in your body you didn't know about, and now we're finding out. And today's just one example. I'm going to take you over to a clip from the from a husband and wife who are both professors, were professors, at Evergreen University and Yale University. And they're evolutionary biologists. They're talking about something brand new. You have not heard this before. This is exclusive today on my program, on radio, about the subclinical manifestations of the COVID vaccine creating subclinical myocarditis. Now, that's not temporary. That doesn't go away. The heart is one of the tissues in the body that cannot rejuvenate cells. It cannot. So what it happens is you injure the heart, it stays injured, it just creates scar tissue, and that causes you to die generally within the next 5 years, depending upon the type of scar and how severe. But what about the kidneys? What about all the others? What if they missed your muscle and the deltoid and they went right into the vein? That's when the big problems occur. And did any nurse, did any doctor, did any pharmacist in America actually take the time when they were sticking the needle in to pull it back to see if there was blood in the needle? No. I mean, everything you can talk about, they could do wrong. So they've got biological time bombs in every single person that got vaccinated, unless you got a placebo. Let's hear what they have to say. And these are highly qualified scientists reporting on the latest scientific study that you will not see or hear anywhere else in the media. You will hear. Let's go to the clip.
Sex-specific differences in myocardial injury incidence after COVID-19 mRNA-1273 booster vaccination. Now, the interesting thing about this study is instead of looking at people who showed up in a medical setting complaining of issues that then turned out to be myocarditis or pericarditis, what they did is they simply censused the blood of people who took a booster for troponins, which are a marker of cellular damage in the heart. Mm-hmm. So in other words, this is a test in some sense of what we've talked about previously on the podcast, which is if you're seeing all of these cases of myocarditis, how many cases are you not seeing because they didn't reach a point where the person sought medical help for them, right? Mm-hmm. They had some pain, they misunderstood what it was, they never showed up in a doctor's office, which is still potentially life-reducing. Right, myocarditis is a serious condition, and it is profoundly associated with shortened lifespan. So it is good to know how many of these subclinical cases there are. Mm-hmm. And in this study, as reported by, do you want to read what you got there?
Yeah, this is just from the abstract.
Among 777 participants, median age 37, 69.5% women. That's just
that's right.
A sample.
40 participants had elevated HSCT&T concentration on day three, and mRNA 1273 vaccine-associated myocardial injury was adjudicated in 22% participants. And one of the interesting things that come out of this is not just the remarkably high rate of heart injury associated with the boosters. It was about 1 in 35. But that, as they say here in the abstract, 20 cases occurred in women, 3.7%, and 2 in men, 0.8%. And these are mild and only temporary. So they are referring to these as transient, which is why presumably they haven't been caught previously. But that it's a much higher rate in women than in men, which is of course the opposite direction of the less transient injury that we've been hearing about more. And of course, what is raised here is what does it mean that it is transient?
Right.
That the indicator is transient is true, but that doesn't mean that there aren't lasting effects.
Right, and in fact, as I have pointed out again and again, the heart is a very special tissue in which damage is, it produces a scar rather than a proper repair. Even in tissues where you have a proper repair, there's a limit in almost all tissues. There are a couple of exceptions, but in almost all tissues, there is a limit to how much repair you can do in a lifetime. So even if you have a repair in which a loss of function is not detectable, what these things do is they advance the aging of those tissues so that you can, you get a certain number of those repairs in life. And if you keep breaking the same thing, you exhaust them early. Right. Or, in my case, I lost.
For WBI, we got to say goodbye. We're continuing on to top of the hour, PRN.live.
Teeth, because an orthodontist moved my teeth too rapidly and he burned up my lifetime capacity for repair in jaw tissue. And so anyway,
your jaw tissue has a higher capacity for repair than your heart does.
Vastly, vastly higher. And it has a built-in system for dealing with minor motions of teeth because your skull shape changes over a lifetime. But put that aside. The heart is one of a small number of tissues that has essentially no capacity for proper repair. That is to say, cells do not get replaced in kind. What they get replaced with is scar tissue that allows the heart to continue to function, but you don't regain the capacity of the fully functional heart that you damaged. So the expectation is these troponins are a useful marker. You ever wonder how, if you have something that seems to be a heart attack and you recover within a couple of days, they can test you and see whether you did have a heart attack? It's markers like this that they use. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the fact that these markers show up suggests damage to the heart. The idea that the markers are transient, as you point out, doesn't mean that the damage is transient. And all of it is pretty scary because myocarditis is demonstrated to be a life-shortening condition. So anyway, one does have the sense that the paper was written to emphasize the transientness. Oh, here's an interesting finding, but maybe it...
I didn't actually get that. I've skimmed the paper and I did not get the sense that they were trying to emphasize the transientness, but trying to be very careful about saying the markers that we used were transient.
Right. But in any case, the idea that if you test people who got this shot without them having to show up reporting a complaint and you find a 1 in 35 rate, and it's not a huge sample size, but nonetheless, 1 in 35 is a huge number of people to have a heart injury from a vaccine that was given where almost all of the people it was given to would have recovered from COVID on its own, didn't need a shot to protect them. And what's more, the shot didn't protect them. The shot did not prevent transmission or contraction. And it even now seems to make contraction of the disease more likely if you get enough of these things. So the whole thing is an incredible debacle.
It raises questions for me, of course, about what this research would look like in people after getting their first first vaccine, because this is, of course, in people already vaccinated, hospital workers already vaccinated, going in for their boosters.
Gary, when do you want to bring
down? You know, is this a higher rate than we would see after a first or second?
Oh, yes, it's a much higher rate. So this is a whole nother concern. People walking around feel, well, I got my shot and my booster, or two booster, three, and I feel fine. You should be tested to see what the markers are in the blood that you could be having a subclinical, meaning not any reaction you would see, not like someone dropping dead playing soccer, but rather damage to the heart that may not be as severe. And with each booster, you increase the odds of that happening again and again and again. So if it's 1 in 30, and that's what they showed in this study, 1 in 30, think of that, then what if you have three boosters? Wow, that's Russian roulette. And this is why I say the worst is yet to come. We could be seeing millions of people adversely affected. And this, you don't get over this. Myocarditis is not something that you grow new tissue and it reverses. It doesn't. Okay? Just letting you know. And finally, today we have a caller on the line. His name is Kenny. And Kenny has a remarkable story, but also he has helped out at our retreats. He does motivational workshops. And this is for those of you who are thinking, should you come down in about a month from now for 1 or 2 weeks at the retreat that we're having? Well, if you want to have quality of life going forward, it's one way to do it. If you want to relax, detoxify, de-stress, that's another thing. If you want to be around like-minded people and have fun and laugh and find joy and wake up feeling that you're in one of the cleanest, most beautiful places, most loving places on earth, yeah, this is it. Luann's number is 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. Hi, Kenny. Tell us your story briefly, please.
Hi, Gary. How are you? So 15 years ago, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and approximately a year after my diagnosis, going through your protocol, I was fully reversed of multiple sclerosis.
Okay. Was it true that you and your wife were coming to a brain anti-aging clinical study, but after one time, your wife said you couldn't make it up the steps, so we helped you up the steps every time, so you were able to finish it?
It is true.
And is it true that your neurologist, two separate teams over the years, told you this was not reversible, that only medicine could slow down some of the symptoms, but you should start to prepare yourself for railings in the house and even on your bed? So you were looking at death.
You're correct, Gary. And when I was in front of the neurologist, you know, I asked them, do you have any vitamins for this? And you know, a lot of people get mad when, you know, conventional medicine really doesn't have anything to offer. But on one hand, I don't really see it as their fault. Really, it's their, you know, it's their training, right? And how many people, when they learn something, they go learn beyond what they've learned in school, right? Continued education or anything like that. So, you know, it really took having to, you know, think outside of the box, go, you know, find other people, look other places, to be able to find ways that I could mitigate my symptoms is how I looked at it at the time, and then ultimately just eliminating them completely.
So when you went back later after completing the protocols and you had no symptoms, but they did all of their tests, the board-certified neurologist, what did they find?
You know what? Nothing short of a miracle, Gary. Nothing short of a miracle. And you know what? Let me tell you. The doctors, you know, they want to cover their behinds, right? And liability, okay? So when you go to them with, you know, complaints and symptoms, and you get the test done, and MRI, spinal tap, and all that stuff, and they find something, and then when you go back, it's like, okay, well, I guess the answer is usually, well, I guess you didn't have it in the first place, right? Because it has to take them off the hook as business people. So that's basically how that goes. You know, you rarely find people that, you know, take ownership of that sort of stuff. So businesses, especially conventional doctors, are no different.
Well, you're living proof of it. All these years later, instead of being in a bed dying,
50 years MS-free.
You are multiple sclerosis free. They can do with it what they want. And this was, there was no charge for any of this. This was all done free to help. And a lot of other people were in that group with you. You saw a woman reverse her end-stage Alzheimer's. You saw another.
And a lot more than that. And let me tell you, it's no different than the miracles that you see occur at, you know, at your retreats. I've seen so many people walk in, you walk out, you know, different people in comparison to how they showed up on so many different levels. Their happiness, how they feel about themselves, their lives, their perspectives, their overall health. We've seen so many people. If you remember, I believe the Indian woman that she had a walker, and after 14 days or so, she was able to make her first steps without a walker. Where else do you see things like that happen?
That was Nelson Mandela's personal physician's wife. She came in a wheelchair because her cousin, who lives in New Jersey, heard about the retreat. Now, mind you, I don't want to give people a false impression. Well, come to the retreat and Gary is going to cure you of anything. I'm not there to diagnose or treat anybody. As you know, I only do lectures and on topics, not on disease. I never talk about disease. Instead, I talk about what we should do with our mind and our body to keep ourselves as healthy as possible. Are you coming down? Are you going to be on staff helping us out come in September, Kenny?
Come September? I'm looking forward to it, Gary.
Well, everybody enjoys your lectures and workshops, and I look forward to it also, Kenny. You're going to be joining a lot of good people, so... That's his name's Kenny. Talk with him personally if you want. He's just one example, only one of many examples of people who...
And there's so many.
...have taken a different approach to conditions and had positive outcomes. If you'd like to join us, again, not because you're sick, dying, and want to spend this time. This is not what a retreat's about. But wonderful things happen at retreats. Wonderful things. Give Luann a call at 903-881-7008. Thank you, Kenny. And thank all of you for listening. Now we're going right into our next show, which is starting right now.